Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in Paper 90, Section 3, which is Old Single Column, page 989. Okay, so if you just, you know, we've got started on this paper on shamanism. If you glance back, you can see just from the section titles that they were, you know, introducing us to the basics of shamanism. We had a few lively conversations. Remember that the major issue that we were wrestling with and looking for the resolution of as we were reading is they start you right out, and it's so obvious that shamanism is, and shamans themselves and the subsequent priests, that phenomenon is fraught with just major, almost calamitous, retrogressive influences on taking evolutionary religion forward. Even if they don't drag things backward, they're giant boat anchors for things to be able to progress forward more rapidly. And so we're going, okay, but it's also obvious that this is completely natural, that every world has nothing to do with rebellions and defaults, that every world has shamans. And so there must be some positive facts that everyone is backing into, in other words, in spite of the negativity of shamanism. And we saw that being highlighted in that very last paragraph we read, right there at the end of section two, that despite all of their issues and how quickly it became basically a wholly deceitful phenomenon, because anyone that was sincere didn't survive. They were executed for not giving successful predictions, determinations on things. But despite all that, and even despite initially wisdom kind of getting shoved aside, remember, it came back around. You began to get rudimentary concepts of knowledge, at least being honored, even if none of the knowledge was true, valid knowledge, but nonetheless a concept of knowledge. Began to get sort of under the radar validation, and even eventually kind of rolled back around and had an appreciation for wisdom. Again, even if in some objective sense one can't say that the wisdom was valid. Nonetheless, if no one has any respect for knowledge and wisdom, there'll never be a quest for the genuine knowledge and wisdom that follows the material comfort era. And so that's what we discovered, that sure enough, like we've seen over and over again, people are backing into the truth in all of these processes that are inescapably natural on every world. Okay, so now we're ready to move forward and get into the details a little bit more about shamanism. And remember how, we're kind of sweeping back through the whole historical spectrum once again with the evolution of religion. Remember how we talked about that whole mystery of death, what a biggie that was, and then disease related to that foundational issue of death. Well, there you see it right in the title. Disease and death, that's the foundational word, and with the near death kind of quote unquote of disease you know, rationalizations about that added on top of that. So they want to address how shamanism is going to play a role in the rationalizing and attempts to deal with the issue of disease and death. Okay, so let's see what they have to say.
Section 3, the shamanic theory of disease and death. Since ancient man regarded himself and his material environment as being directly responsive to the whims of the ghosts and the fancies of the spirits, it is not strange that his religion should have been so exclusively concerned with material affairs. Modern man attacks his material problems directly. He recognizes that matter is responsive to the intelligent manipulation of mind. Primitive man likewise desired to modify and even to control the life and energies of the physical domains. And since his limited comprehension of the cosmos led him to the belief that ghosts, spirits, and gods were personally and immediately concerned with the detailed control of life and matter, he logically directed his efforts to winning the favor and support of these superhuman agencies.
Okay, so we've got an opportunity to think once again about this still almost universal assumption. You know, whether it's ghosts or spirits or gods or, you know, all three. You know, this whole issue about whether or not they have any direct engagement in material affairs. You know, and you know, we all know, as they're pointing out there, that's always been the assumption. We all know it's, like I just said, still basically the assumption. Almost all prayers are predicated on that assumption. And you know, as they're pointing out between the lines there, it's obvious that okay, it's not a valid assumption. But it's interesting that they're giving you another way to kind of think about how it's not as completely arbitrary assumption as it initially appears to be. You know, it's not as just purely superstitious as it initially appears to be. You know, notice what they threw in the middle there. About how, you know, what do we do now? We're still trying to control the material world, and we're trying to do it because we recognize that, as they say there, he recognizes, you know, us now, that matter is responsive to the intelligent manipulation of mind. And so even if that isn't a conscious recognition in a primitive individual, you know, they're, for instance, not even consciously thinking about that most rudimentary example I always bring up. You know, one day you notice that your hand is moving around in front of your face. And you go, huh, I wonder what makes it move. Well, it seems like I just think it and it moves. Huh, it seems like mind has this control over matter. Oh, yeah, now that I think about it, I can reach over and pick up this cup, too. I mean, it's not like that cup will just float up in the air by itself. Oh, so I could, if I've thought about this a little bit, maybe there's a particular way I could move matter around that would be very helpful to myself and humans in general. All right, so, you know, that those gears start turning. You know, that eventually lead to scientific exploration and lots of scientific discovery, you know, so that, you know, you can eventually figure out how to move molecules around and cure cancer. Okay. And so, you know, that's all, you know, all of that, it was not there consciously, but it's all kind of under the surface, and even the most primitive mind, as they've kind of pointed out a number of times, you know, there is this subtle, unrecognized, unwittingly, unrecognized assumption that mind, you know, has an engagement to matter. And notice they even threw in, and they talk about the whims of ghosts and the fancies of spirits. Yeah, I often point out, right, that, you know, even today, no one literally is thinking of spirit as it really is, a separate substance. Right? When they use the word spirit, spiritual, they're talking about fancy mind, the fancies of spirit. See, they're even kind of hinting at that right there. That, you know, so put those two together, right? That you without any sort of reflective engagement, you kind of have spirit is fancy mind going on in people's head. And mind, you know, being able to, you know, do things with matter. And so it actually, there's this subtle unconscious reinforcement that the spirits directly can, you know, a spirit could pick up this cup and make it float if it wanted to, right? Or a spirit could reach inside of me and manipulate me and give me a disease. So that's kind of an interesting little thing to think about, that because humans, by grace, have a personal living philosophy, and for, you know, long ages, they're utterly oblivious to that fact, okay, but nonetheless, it's there. It, over and over again, we see that subtle little bits of logical synthesis are going on. You know, it's not a true logic, but there's a desire for a synthetic logical space, and, you know, and so they end up with a false logic, of course, but a logic nonetheless. Okay, so yeah, that just, you know, again, if you aren't so knee jerk in being in denigrating them for, you know, ancient peoples for their superstitions, so you can cut them a little slack here. They aren't as hopeless as they appear to be in the way they're thinking about things. Okay, so that's an interesting point. It's obviously going to, if we're going to talk about this whole issue of shamanic engagement of disease, you know, this is going to come back around again, the relationship of mind to matter and what beliefs that mind has. Mind can, you know, manipulate matter, as they're saying there. You know, you remember the literalness of manipulation. Mind, in some way, is hands-on, right? We know that there's going to be a possibility for disease to be affected by very definitively consecrated mind. Yep.
And to the corollary of that, doesn't spirit dominate mind? In other words,
right.
Dominates the right word, but.
Yeah, no, spirit dominates mind, mind dominates matter. Right?
So if you have mind, you know, mind dominating matter, in effect, because spirit dominates mind, there may be some influence there.
Right, but, you know, and we'll get, yeah, right, we actually see they'll bring that out, that in us, where it's appropriate to say, spirit dominates mind, you know, mind dominates matter. But just because spirit dominates mind, don't think that a quote-unquote spirit being can dominate your mind, right? I mean, that's a separate issue.
No, it's your spirit.
But you, with your personality grip on spirit, you can dominate your mind, and that will obviously boost the effectiveness of mind over matter.
That's what I
would think. Right? It'll put us a spiritual strength in that mind. It's going to be more solid and hence more impactful on the matter than if it didn't have those that spiritization, the, you know, that sort of warp, you know,
maybe,
if you will,
creative.
Woven into it, right?
Maybe more creative.
Yeah, of course, even more creative. Yeah. So you know, we'll see that they actually bring that out, and it's important to kind of have that in your head so that you don't. I think it's even appropriate to say misinterpret what they will say later on. Yeah, you take yourself off on a wrong tangent. Okay, let's see, anything else there? Okay, just, you know, let me just emphasize as we go forward. You notice that they said he logically directed, like I said. So, see, there's a logic there, right? And they're even making a point of that. But this whole issue of this assumption, no matter if we can kind of understand more why that assumption came into being, and we aren't so hard on the assumption, you have this just really never questioned assumption that God and his angels and whatnot, if they want to, can play around with matter. And I can pray relative to that. Now, I'm emphasizing the prayer thing because they're going to bring it up. And, of course, we're right on the doorstep of the next paper where we're going to talk about that. Okay, so we want to kind of begin to steel ourselves for facing this fact of lifting prayer up above these ancient assumptions about the relationship between spirit and matter, spirits and matter. All right, let's go.
Viewed in this light, much of the inexplicable and irrational in the ancient cults is understandable. The ceremonies of the cult were primitive man's attempt to control the material world in which he found himself, and many of his efforts were directed to the end of prolonging life and ensuring health. Since all diseases and death itself were originally regarded as spirit phenomena, it was inevitable that the shamans, while functioning as medicine men and priests, should also have labored as doctors and surgeons.
Okay, so, yeah, yeehaw. And notice that they're pointing out that, there's that initial kind of just total woo-woo medicine man function. But we were pointing out at the beginning, as they told us, what we've read already in this paper, you begin to get kind of a knowledge, concept going. So don't be surprised if it doesn't keep rolling forward and they start to get a little bit more scientific-like and technological-like, okay, and in the way they're engaging things, and so you can actually talk about surgery, right, with a very kind of precise notion in mind, about doing it. Okay. It's not just going to be the fuzzy medicine man thing forever, because you've got the juices of knowledge flowing. I mean, if not literally knowledge, you at least have the spirit of knowledge, right? You've got the fourth adjutant. So there's that. And then, of course, right in the middle, you can see it again. They're hinting at it. And many of his efforts were directed to the end of prolonging life and ensuring health. But heavens, not our efforts now with prayer. Right? Yeah. Okay. All right. How much prayer is directed to the end of prolonging life and ensuring health? Yeah.
I pick up the prayer request.
Yeah. And again, remember, we're not setting up a dichotomy. We're not here to demonize prayer. We're just here to try to not existentialize a very early evolutionary concept of prayer. We want prayer to be liberated so it can evolve forward to higher levels as it was intended to do, as it was designed to do. It's not that this primitive prayer is bad. It's very, very important to moving mankind forward. But, it all good things in that evolutionary sense, you take into extreme, will become bad. If you carry it beyond its evolutionary appropriateness, it ceases to be a good thing. It begins to become a bad thing in that primitive form. It needs to be upgraded so that it's good again. It needs to follow the evolutionary stream forward. All right, let's keep going.
The primitive mind may be handicapped by lack of facts, but it is for all that logical. When thoughtful men observed disease and death, they set about to determine the causes of these visitations. And in accordance with their understanding, the shamans and the scientists have propounded the following theories of affliction.
Okay, see, so again, notice how they're just stressing the logical again. And, you know, obviously it's not in some very, very high sense, totally non-linear sense logic, okay, but it's at least a logical acumen, the first cosmic intuition, like they said right there. He set about to determine the causes. It's only because of the influence of the first cosmic intuition that anyone ever goes in search of a cause. Right? That's what gives you the concept of causality. Without it, right, it would never, ever appear in your mind to seek for a cause. No animal is searching for any cause, no matter how fancy the animal is. Okay? So, right, that beginning point, acumen, right, of logic, that logical acumen, that first cosmic intuition, basically, if it goes beyond just that little stimulus of insight, it's going to be, they're going to attempt to reason, right? They're going to attempt to start with a factual, causal, initial assumption and rationally move forward from that. They're going to attempt to reason. Okay, so how did this go? Right? There's going to be, they're going to find some rationale, right? They're going to rationalize it. So they're going to quote-unquote understand it. I remember understanding is a very relative term. Whatever rationale you have, no matter how false that rationale is, right, it can give you the comfort of an understanding. And remember, that's how we have always defined the word truth, as correct understanding. Right? Humans don't know genuine truth, as the Rancho book is talking about. All they know is what they call correct understanding, see, and it's all relative to this. You have some rationale, right? So, if you conform to that, it's a correct understanding. It's quote-unquote true. And you will completely be confused even about what it is that's in your lap, let alone any details of what's in there. It's called a revelation of truth. It's a revelation of correct understanding. No, it's not a revelation of correct understanding, right? There may be coordinated essential knowledge, but it's a lot more than that. Right? It's a revelation of truth.
Okay.
Yep.
Now we use the word truth in a lesser way when we're talking about being factually correct. Like you're talking about, we still use that word in that lesser way. I think
both
does too.
Yeah, humans use the word in, at best, correct understanding, and sometimes, simply as a synonym for, fact or, what? I mean, we use it in lots of ways. We love to use it. It feels wonderful to use the word. I'm true,
I thought there's validity but,
there is, in human usage, there's all that, there's validity. But that's not how the Urantia book uses it.
But I thought they do use it in a lesser way also.
They don't. No, they don't.
Okay, I'm gonna find out.
At times they will use some fact words, like we'll see shortly, the word faith, for instance, where they're telling you that, okay, super consciously there's that fact and someone is playing off the shadow, so you can kind of use that fact word like faith in that context. But truth is different than those usages like that. Or the word morality, can be used kind of in the, what's technically just more conformity and not, literally moral in the proper sense of the book. Or we see him using the word worship all over in these papers. Okay, and they're not talking about that genuine worship thing, in general, right, as a fact. But see, truth is different. You can't use the word truth in that sort of a way and have its use still be true. You can use the word faith or morality or, you know, in that way, and it's still a true usage, even if it isn't, directly a conscious, factual thing that's in play, okay? That's why it's so important to understand about if you see them saying truth or if you see them modifying, say, the word religion by true religion, okay, that's you can't think any definition in the dictionary for that adjective true. You know, to understand what they're talking about. They're talking about something that humans, as Pontius Pilate knew, have not been able to figure out, quid est veritas. Right? That's what the revelators are talking about. You know, how many times I say, it's like, well, that's not in fact the case, but in truth it's the case. See, you know, you can talk about it, but you can't say, well, that's not in truth the case, that's in, See, I mean, there is, because the reason you don't have that sort of relativity to play with the word truth, is it's the truths of eternity. It's not like the facts of time that are inherently relative. Right? There's no relativity with eternity. It's absolute. Right? So it's very important to not let your interpretation of the word true kind of be taken off for the clever rationalization scheme. Okay, let's see. Where were we? We're ready to start the list. I think we did everything there, didn't we? We get off in these tangents. I think we got everything. Yep, go ahead.
The shamans and the scientists have propounded the following theories of affliction. 1. Ghosts, direct spirit influences. The earliest hypothesis advanced in explanation of disease and death was that spirits caused disease by enticing the soul out of the body. If it failed to return, death ensued. The ancients so feared the malevolent action of disease-producing ghosts that ailing individuals would often be deserted without even food or water. Regardless of the erroneous basis for these beliefs, they did effectively isolate afflicted individuals and prevent the spread of contagious disease.
So, you know, that's one of those harsh little facts of the evolutionary process. Yeah, they just, whatever, let's just, you know, let's get a fart, you know, no food, no water, you know. Wow, talk about caring for the sick. But at least you didn't have the entire tribe dying off of some contagious disease. So in the evolutionary process, that was appropriate. As they're, you know, what they're telling you in between the lines there. Obviously this would be number one, because we've already studied that. That's the whole basic ghost cult concept. That's how it all starts. And before there's any sort of sophistication to it, you know, it is, you know, just very definitively a complete lifestyle solution. I mean, everything, without exception, is being rationalized in that, you know, directly in that ghost cult way. You know, so that's got to be the number one on this list. And obviously where we'll go next is they're just going to bring in these little things that we've already studied that begin to modify the very simple, or maybe simplistic, ghost cult concept. That's obviously where this is, you know, is how this is going to roll out. But notice that they are not just saying ghosts, they're bringing in spirits. And so you could have had that evolution of going beyond just ghosts to those advanced, quote-unquote, you know, elevated advanced ghosts, quote-unquote, spirits. You know, that could be in play, and it's still just in this very rudimentary state. Did you?
Yeah.
You have something?
Well, I was interested in the fact that, you know, the whole concept of the soul being out of the body and it didn't return, mm-hmm. death ensued. Mm-hmm. So they had that at least concept of the value of the soul in the body now, you know, what their concept of soul was. I don't.
Right, of course. You know, we know that.
Different than the spirit.
Think about what if it was that your concept of the soul was your shadow. You know, like somebody, it's like, ooh, is my shadow already out of my body? You know, so they, you know, you wonder how that rationalization scheme would have gone. But, see, maybe those that were thinking this, the shadow was the soul or one of the souls, didn't kind of have the fullness of this rationalization scheme because obviously it was complicated. But it may very well have led to, they still believed that the shadow was a soul. Remember, he had beliefs in multiple souls. He goes, oh, maybe that's one of the reasons why multiple soul concepts developed, because they couldn't rationalize very easily with the soul being out of the body to explain disease when the shadow is already out of the body. So, there must be another soul.
Well, see, they may not have had the fact of the soul right, but just the fact that they're the concept of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were, I imagine, a long time ago. I mean, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and you can even think, the soul doesn't have anything to do with physical disease and stuff. It's like, well, okay, but, you know, think about when they talk about death. There's spirit death, mind death, physical death. All right, see, there's a higher kind of validity to the adjuster disconnecting, at spiritual death, and then the soul goes away. See, that's why you can always think about this and say, even though they're completely oblivious to such things, you have to almost wonder, it's like, but do you suppose in a very subtle way, there that super conscious, valid recognition way up there casts a little shadow down, like I was explaining with the first paragraph here, casts a little shadow down, kind of gets it going in the superstitious scheme that it went, right? After all, right, just because no one in human history has known what the definition of the word truth is, everyone loves to use it, and it's in the dictionary. It's like, it's not we don't have the word, right? So, I mean, it's not just words that sort of just come into our heads and we don't know how to define them. Right? A whole kind of, the essence of all kinds of processes and stuff are in our heads and are kind of vaguely, we're trying to figure out how to, you know, not just what to put a word on, but what to align a process with, right? We kind of have a sense of some of these processes, and we're in search of what to identify them with, And when you don't have literal spirit substance, there's all kinds of misidentifications, right, of concepts, words, processes, to inappropriately to material affairs.
So are you saying, is there a difference between using the word truth and true in what you're talking about? Because here it says it is true that Satan did periodically visit Caligastia, for instance. Like, we say that word a lot, I don't understand.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm trying to get at. You go, well, it looks like they're just saying it's a fact.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to tell you, no. If all they wanted you to think about was the fact of it, they would have said fact. When they say true, they want you to go beyond the immediacy of the fact of what they're saying. And remember, the basic thing that saying truth instead of fact brings in, fact is about a part, truth is about a whole. So when you say it's true, they're wanting you to think in a more holistic context, maybe they want you to think most directly about fact points, but they don't want you to divorce those fact points from a holistic context. And that's why they said true, okay? I mean, to say true implies fact. Truth implies fact, but fact doesn't imply truth. Right, I mean, remember, truth is a super additive consequence between fact and goodness. And we're talking about, in an evolutionary sense, truth and goodness. Right? So, I mean, you can't get that kind of truth except predicated on fact. You see, so truth implies fact. But fact doesn't imply truth. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. they said what it appears they're saying about the fact of it, but they're saying, but there's more to it. Don't just think of just about the fact point of it. Don't think so scientifically about that sentence is what they're actually telling you to do. Don't think so scientifically, merely scientifically about it. Think philosophically about the sentence. That's why they said true. And within the context of that philosophic sphere, you have that science, the fact stuff of the sentence that was immediately apparent to you. But guess what you also have in the context of that philosophic sphere? Not just science, you also have religion, right? In the context of... See, so when you say true, it gets you to think about the whole picture, not just, you know, how we've been trained post-Enlightenment at times to be over-fixated on the facts, okay? And to just think about facts and define all of our words relative to science, basically, right? See, which is going to drive you to philosophic materialism, right? It's going to drive you away from mind and spirit, you know, if you keep on that track, which, of course, is what it did. Drove all the fancy thinkers, right, back to philosophic materialism, right? Because they got overemphasized on the science, you know, so that it's science-ism, right? Okay, so yeah, that just keep that in mind. That's the challenge. I mean, you see that all over when you're reading papers 99 through 103. Notice if they say true religion, or if they say merely real religion, or merely genuine religion. Right, don't think of those as synonyms. Right? The most encompassing thing to say is true religion. That's bringing in all sorts of things within the wholeness. And they say, you know, and they're just saying real religion. Okay, and they're just getting you to focus on the direct fact of just that religious point, you know, setting aside the big picture for a moment. But when they say true religion, they want you to think about real religion in the context of a whole, so that it's also true religion. For instance, that's a simple example. It is very much in play in those religion papers. Okay, meanwhile, back to shamanic theories of disease and death. Okay, so so we've got just the basic ghost cult concept. So what do we add to that next?
Two, violence, obvious causes. The causes for some accidents and deaths were so easy to identify that they were early removed from the category of ghost action. Fatalities and wounds attendant upon war, animal combat, and other readily identifiable agencies were considered as natural occurrences. But it was long believed that the spirits were still responsible for delayed healing or for the infection of wounds of even natural causation. If no observable natural agent could be discovered, the spirit ghosts were still held responsible for disease and death.
Okay, so right there you see again, like we've seen over and over again, and we just saw again with shamanism, you know, inescapably, you know, there were various influences to get you thinking more precisely. And sure enough, you're going to have crude scientific consciousness is going to start to come into play a little bit. So they'll start thinking, you know, basically scientifically about some deaths, you know, so it all isn't just one giant mystical fuzz, right? Magical fuzz. Certain things they're going to technically think of scientifically. Ah, Bob shoved a spear through his heart. I think that's the cause of his death, right? And, but just think about being so primitive that that doesn't occur to you immediately, because humans originally were that primitive, that they aren't even putting those kind of really simple two and two, you know, together like that. It's like, well, how is that possible? Because, you know, for us, you know, we can't even imagine being so clueless like that. But But you have to go back to a very, very fearful, primitive mind that, remember, like I told you as we began this evolutionary religion story, discovers this exquisite fear with the ghost cult. A fear so powerful that it just completely clouds the mind. Right? You go, oh, actually, I can understand how they could not put the simple two and two together. Everyone knows when when someone who's gotten so just, you know, apoplectically filled with terror, right? Just all, I mean, relationship to fact and basic logical recognition is all just shut down, and they do the most stupid things, right? They can't just, the obvious thing. Oh, there's a really scary thing in front of me. Should I run away from it or run towards it? You know, duh. right? It's so easy. I mean, even take something simple, kind of playing off of that. How difficult it is to kind of keep a bigger picture in mind. You watch young kids playing soccer, and you've got these tiny little kids in this great big goal. So you got this tiny little goalie in this great big goal space. And here comes the kid with the ball. And does he kick it, in the 50 feet of open goal area? No, he rolls it slowly right at the goalie. Okay? Right, it's that same thing. They're going, what are you thinking? See, they're not. Okay? Same thing. Obviously, if you add fear in, just any sort of trivially self-evident thing is gone. Right? Even something as trivial as, I'm pretty sure that the why that person died is because that lion bit his head off. They don't even really notice that. They're so filled with fear of the ghosts and stuff that they've got some ghost fear thing scheme in their head. Okay. It took a little while for it to get to the point. Again, remember, you're starting with Andonites who couldn't even imagine the concept of a grandchild, right? It was too abstract for them. Child was tangible. Okay. So again, we're talking about very limited people. Yep.
So, I still see this today. I do this pastoral care ministry, and I go in with people, and they're dying, and they say, why is God doing this to me?
Yeah.
It's turned into God doing it to
you. Right, sure.
Why won't he heal me? Or why is he making me sick? This one person...
God gave me cancer, and now he's giving me pneumonia, too. Why?
And then my first question was, well, do you believe in life after death? I don't believe in God anymore, because look what he's done to me. it's not changed a whole lot.
It's like, wait a minute, of course you believe in God. You believe God did it to you. Duh!
Who made you sick again? That's true, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
People have turned it from the spirits to the real big spirit.
Yeah, right.
Big spirit.
Yes, the spirit in the sky, as the song goes, right? Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know what I'm saying. So it's not really gone.
Right. No, of course it's not.
No.
And see, the reason it's not gone is because, like we've been trying to study here, it can't be really gone. It's natural. There is no human mind that doesn't, at its foundation, naturally think that way. It's just the way the animal origin you thinks. No matter how much you don't, it's like, no, I don't think that way. That's because that's way down in your subconscious, mind now, right? But that part is still there. It can't be anything but there. It's just a way mind attuned to this biology thinks. Right? So, if someone is in dire stress, don't be surprised. All the higher levels peel down. They're back down to that rudimentary mind that's laying right there on their brain, and guess the way it thinks. It thinks just like a primitive person thought, because it can't think any other way.
And then it activates the fear.
Right.
And all of that together.
And that just makes it worse. The more fear, which is a poison to the higher, reasoning, all that, like I was saying, you can easily erase, seemingly, all of that higher stuff if you juice the fear up enough. You know, and as they tried to stress at the beginning, a modern person just really can't, you know, you can kind of sort of analogize like we just were, but technically you can't imagine just how fearful they were. The fear that they had was so beyond anything that you've ever, you know, even seen dramatized, you know, in some show or something. I mean, it was just unbelievable fear that they could generate in their minds.
Refresh my memory. Do we take fear with us to the mansion worlds?
No, because fear is animal origin, right? But you're going to take the distortions of your soul that are predicated on having fear to begin with there. It takes you the first two mansion worlds to work through all the, you know, the indirect effects of fear. But at least you won't have those effects being regenerated there.
That emotional fear, that thing, that animalistic, instinct or whatever is gone.
Yeah. And, which is true of, just, like I've pointed out with all those sorts of things, you know, because there you don't serve two masters. So, you know, down here, if I erase something, unfortunately, I haven't erased the generator. And it gets regenerated, bottom up, that stuff here. But up there, if you erase it, it's gone, because there's no bottom up generator to regenerate that unfortunate thing that you finally erased. See, that is a good news. Okay, finally, I can just erase it and be done with it. It's never going to haunt me again.
Well, one of the most common fears is fear about what other people are thinking of me. Mm-hmm. So how is that not still there?
Right. See, we can't even imagine how that's not still there, right? See, because it's just our mind is founded on that fear.
Right? It'll be pretty transparent.
It's going to be very different, right, to not have a level of fear in your mind anymore, right? The foundation of every, you know, like we've been studying here. Well, all there is fear to begin with. Let's see, I could elevate it to anguish and dread, and then I could elevate it further into awe and reverence, right? I can fear anew. But it's not really fear, it's reverence now. No, what does the word reverence mean? It means fear anew, right? That's all you've got in the lower domain is fear. Sure, it's finally very sublime and exalted, you know, as reverence, but it's still just fear, fancy fear.
The book talks about how Jesus got through that.
The cool thing about reverence is, despite the etymology of the word, you can generate a reverence from the top down. There's a flavor of reverence that doesn't come from the bottom up as fear. So it isn't literally reverence, but we'll use the same word again, like, so we don't have to just coin another one, you know, right now. But, you know, when they talk about genuine worship, on the sixth level of meaning, that coming down to the second level of meaning as a newfound reverence, right? When you read about the three cosmic intuitions in 16.6, right, they're speaking about a whole new kind of reverence, a reverence that it's a downstepped expression of fear, I mean a downstepped expression of worship instead of an upstepped expression of fear. A downstepped expression of worship instead of an upstepped expression of fear. Right? That's the kind of reverence you should be curious about right now. I wonder what that's like. Right? Okay. Let's see. Anything else we had there? Right, we got the natural thing. You know, notice how we're, you know, quote unquote natural, right? And you take that to the Enlightenment, and of course you get naturalism, you know, and which is effectively philosophic materialism, right? Just because some things are quote unquote natural doesn't mean everything is in that same quote unquote sense natural, right? That it's all just matter. Okay. But to John's point about how, you know, why is God doing, you know, how we still keep this going? Notice the last sentence, right? This is obviously, since it was the beginning, it was everything, it's always going to be the fallback position, right? Rudimentary science, or even more genuine science, will peel away a bunch of things. But whenever there's mystery relative to science, right, the ghost cult is going to fill the void, right, in current human thinking. Okay.
Today in Africa and elsewhere may be found primitive peoples who kill someone every time a nonviolent death occurs. Their medicine men indicate the guilty parties. If a mother dies in childbirth, the child is immediately strangled. A life for a life.
Yeah, so see, they're reminding you, it's that whole balance, you know, of life scheme, which of course is very dominating in human thinking still. Right, everything's a zero-sum game, like we talked about before. And of course, you know, slipped into the middle is reminding you of what we learned about shamans, you know, prior to this. Oh, the medicine men indicate the guilty party. So the shaman has an enemy in the tribe who's jealous of, you know, all the perks that the shaman has. Coincidentally, that's the person who gets the finger pointed at. He did it, you know. Problem solved. The enemy's gone. Right. You know, and like we said, oh, gee, that sounds an awful lot like politics. Yeah, like we talked about last time, right? All of the schemes of the political sphere were, you know, discovered by the shamans and perfected, if you will, by the shamans, you know, and carried forward not just by the priests of today, but by the politicians of today and many others, like they were explaining to us. You know, those old sort of ways of the world, if you will, right, were established long ago. Okay, so the next thing, see, now we started with all the literalness of the ghost cult, and obviously what's going to come next is as we started to abstract away from everything being so literally about spirit or ghost beings, you know, literally doing things, we start to get that abstraction of magic. All right, comes in next.
3, magic, the influence of enemies. Much sickness was thought to be caused by bewitchment, the action of the evil eye, and the magic pointing bow. At one time, it was really dangerous to point a finger at anyone. It is still regarded as ill-mannered to point. In cases of obscure disease and death, the ancients would hold a formal inquest, dissect the body, and settle upon some finding as the cause of death. Otherwise, the death would be laid to witchcraft, thus necessitating the execution of the witch responsible therefor. These ancient coroner's inquests saved many a supposed witch's life. Among some, it was believed that a tribesman could die as a result of his own witchcraft, in which event no one was accused.
Okay, so notice you got a little bit of a flip side. Because when you make it more abstract, it opens up more clever schemes and machinations and stuff. And so you could actually have this, you know, coroner, quote unquote, you know, maybe the witch that's, you know, being accused, you know, there's a little bit of a sexual relationship going on the side with the shaman here who's making the examination, and he doesn't want this witch to be executed. So coincidentally, he finds something in the entrails that indicate that it doesn't have anything to do with witchcraft. It has to do with blah, 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 all right? And she doesn't get executed, you know. Obviously, you can just sort of the sky's the limit for all of the scheming here and playing around with this. Well, once it gets more and more abstract, you know, as soon as you bring in, you know, magic, remember, it finally is even kind of taken sort of fully abstract, where you kind of just think that there's sort of just disembodied magic, sort of a drift, even kind of, you know, and You know, and they're you know, you don't even really have kind of a being, a sorcerer or something behind this magic, you know, reaching out across space and, you know, to engage someone. It opens up lots of possibilities. And that's, like we talked about, it's in that fullness of kind of anything goes that you have current religious theology. You know, there's basically no limits. If they can dream up some mystical, magical scheme, you know, involving good oozes and bad oozes and whatnot, right? I mean, you know, everyone accepts that as a valid explanation of how the universe works.
Never heard of a magic pointing bow.
Obviously a variation of, you know, literally using the sort of a bow-shaped stick is a straight stick of a wand, a magic wand, right? It just, you know, there was a whole fascination with, you know, like they mentioned, of various wand-like, you know, objects. And again, it's just, see, you fixate on just the fact that, you know, you follow the curve of this object. And you can extrapolate, and it's like magically the object extends all the way and touches someone, and you become fascinated by that concept of being able to visualize an extension of that line, whether it's a curved line or a straight line, or whatever. It's those sorts of initial kind of fascinations of thought that they fixate on and aggrandize into a whole scheme. Remember, another thing we saw was the concept of an object that had a hole through it, you know, and your imagination can just start running wild of, you know, what that means. It's like, wow, you know, I mean, maybe if you go through the hole, you kind of go into a whole nother universe. Oh, gee, like Alice in Wonderland or something. See, you know, we play, or black holes now, as wormholes and all that, right? See, we're still playing with those sorts of ideas of a mystical, you know, opening, you know, that, you know, it looks like it's just this. Or, you know, think about, often in movies with, you know, with where you've got dragons and orcs and, you know, witches and whatnot, they'll have one of these magic portals. You know, there's just this stone portal sitting out in the middle of nowhere, right? And you can look at it from all sides, you know, you can see through it this way, you can see through it this way. But if you do some, you know, magic little woo-woo thing, right, you walk through the portal and you go into a totally different, you know, domain. See, all of that's the same scheme that has just been rediscovered with general relativity and wormholes and all that. Which goes, you know, that probably means that there's a false initial assumption with general relativity. The very fact that it leads me right back to magical holes and coins and objects and magic portals and, yeah, see, right? You know, the fact that your science is indistinguishable from mythological tales is telling you something, right? It's not really science. It's science fiction. Okay, so anyway, that's the kind of stuff. They're just fascinated with that, you know, things, you know, very simple things like a line, a linear object or a perforated object. Okay, let's see here. Anything else there? Just the last little thing, you have that little twist at the end. You know, you see this still in the stories we tell too, like in some of those, you know, mythological tales. You often have the concept that, well, you know, the more you practice that magic, the more it affects you. And each time the young lad does it, you know, he becomes a little bit, you know, more negatively impacted, you know, and either it sort of drives him to the dark side, or it literally is sucking all the life out of him, and he's on the verge of death. See, we still tell those kinds of stories.
Horcruxes.
All right.
4, sin, punishment for taboo violation. In comparatively recent times, it has been believed that sickness is a punishment for sin, personal or racial. Among peoples traversing this level of evolution, the prevailing theory is that one cannot be afflicted unless one has violated a taboo. To regard sickness and suffering as arrows of the Almighty within them, unquote, is typical of such beliefs. The Chinese and Mesopotamians long regarded disease as the result of the action of evil demons, although the Chaldeans also looked upon the stars as the cause of suffering. This theory of disease was a consequence of divine wrath, is still prevalent among many reputedly civilized groups of your ancients.
So there we are back to what you were bringing up early. And again, are they gentle, or are they kind of give us truth in a little bit more rugged fashion than, you know, Jesus might have, for instance? Yeah, reputedly civilized groups. Again, they're just trying to remind you, okay, you can put the cloak of civilization around you, but okay, doesn't make you really civilized if you've got all of these thoughts that are as primitive can be. And of course, you know, we've also mentioned how, you know, with those residual Sumerians, if you will, the Chaldeans, you know, you get astrology, you know, very much kind of perpetuated forward into, you know, into current times by them. You know, why do we have the word magic? The Magi, right? The Chaldeans. And, you know, when they give that quote unquote arrows of the Almighty within them, does anyone know what they're referring to as something from comparatively recent times, quote unquote? That's Job. Yeah, Job is, you know, describing his state, you know, that, you know, that the arrows of the Almighty are within him. You know, why? You know, why is God doing this to me? You know, and he's searching for the answer. And of course, you know, as the revelators point out, regardless of all of the falseness of the assumptions and stuff and his unfortunate laboring under those assumptions like this, when all is said and done, he decides, even though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Right? So he transcends all the superstition and falsehood and stuff and gets to something real. Right? And that's just as valid now if you reject all the superstitions that led him to that that conclusion. You should be able to courageously and independently take that on, because that's the reality of it. He is going to slay you. Right? Maybe you won't use the word slay because it's mere mortal death. Doesn't seem, it's not like he reaches down a thunderbolt and vaporizes you. But nonetheless, he made you to die. Right? You have to face that fact. Right? That God kills every mortal. He made them to die. Right? He's going to slay you in that sense. You should face that fact and serve him transcendent of that fact, right? Getting beyond that whole bit of, how did they say that there? And many of his efforts were directed to the end of prolonging life and ensuring health, right? That's how you get past that, praying for prolonging life and ensuring health and stuff. You got to start with that. Even though he slay me, yet will I serve him. I don't pray for myself materially. I pray as a means, as a ladder that I'm going to climb up to Thanksgiving, and through Thanksgiving I'm going to get to worship. That's why I pray. I pray as a means to an end, not an end in itself, and certainly not a selfish end in itself. All right. So see, all that, you can bring in all that just by recognizing who's the quote it is. You know, I'm thinking about Job, the example of Job. Okay, so, but in general, right, we've gone from magic. Remember, we went through the whole sequence, and finally we got to the full-on transgression of taboo and sin. So, right here. We're back to that point again, relative to disease and death. You know, once you finally have the concept of sin and redemption and atonement and all these various things, right, you've got that fancy now scheme about disease and death. Okay, and then what happens?
5, natural causation. Mankind has been very slow to learn the material secrets of the interrelationship of cause and effect in the physical domains of energy, matter, and life. The ancient Greeks, having preserved the traditions of Adamson's teachings, were among the first to recognize that all disease is the result of natural causes. Slowly and certainly, the unfolding of a scientific era is destroying man's age-old theories of sickness and death. Fever was one of the first human ailments to be removed from the category of supernatural disorders. And progressively, the era of science has broken the fetters of ignorance which so long imprisoned the human mind. An understanding of old age and contagion is gradually obliterating man's fear of ghosts, spirits, and gods as the personal perpetrators of human misery and mortal suffering.
What if you took that all the way and went beyond the fear of capital G God? Might you, for the first time, be able to finally get to the God of love? Yeah, so like they're pointing out, it began in earnest in the 6th century B.C. with the Greeks. And of course, we all know that by the time you get to the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the 3 centuries of the Enlightenment, right, it reaches a reasonable beginning full flower. And you know, for many, they don't immediately turn to, why is God doing this to me? Right? They don't go to their priest. They go to the Mayo Clinic or something. Right? But like we were saying, you stress that person hard enough, or if death is looming imminently, and they're laying there in their last few hours, don't be surprised if all that evaporates and and they kind of are struggling again in a more primitive mode. And kind of, unfortunately, end up going kind of howling at God. Now we just need to, you know, go back to the and pick up that thread at the beginning of the 20th century and carry it up again, because we didn't bring in the philosophic recognition to carry up the scientific thread higher. Right? The scientific thread is, you know, sort of plateaued, and you know, for a few decades, and by the middle of the 20th century, it was losing its inertia and has been declining ever since. Despite the even in very recent years, you know, wonderful technological advances. Science itself, you know, like we were just talking about, is becoming more and more primitive and mystical all the time. And so, unfortunately, these technological advances that we're delighting in here recently, you know, are in jeopardy of all of evaporating on us in the not-too-distant future. If we just descend into the magic of black holes and all this sort of stuff, okay, like we were saying, which is no different than the mystical portal, you know. We all know that's why the book is here. So that there can be a point number 6 in this list, and not going back to 4, and then back to 3, and then back to 2, and then back to 1, right? Not going into an interregnum where you end up all the way back with item number 1 and have to work your way all up to number 5 again, all over again. The quest for knowledge and wisdom needs to generate item number 6. All right.
Evolution unerringly achieves its end. It imbues man with that superstitious fear of the unknown and dread of the unseen, which is the scaffolding for the God concept. And having witnessed the birth of an advanced comprehension of deity, through the coordinate action of revelation, the same technique of evolution then unerringly sets in motion those forces of thought, which will inexorably obliterate the scaffolding, which has served its purpose.
Yeah, any kind of shades of that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. But notice, you know, they're pointing out that you leveraged forward with some revelation. Can we leverage ourselves forward with the fifth epical revelation, like I was just saying, so that there can be an item number six? And the other thing that's there, a couple other things. I mean, one, that thing about inexorably obliterating the scaffolding, that's, for instance, like what I was just saying a while ago about prayer, right? Eventually, in order to get to prayer born again, you have to allow a process to obliterate the old prayer. Right? You can't hold on to the old, you know, and genuinely achieve new. You can't hold on to the God of fear and actually get to the God of love, for instance, like I said, you know, just a second ago. All those different parallels. That's very important to always think about that, you know, about things in that evolutionary context of quote unquote scaffolding. Then the other thing is, notice, and they said it twice, unerringly. Right, that the evolutionary process has no error in it. You know, let that sink in. Right? There's a strong tendency when we overplay the universal father and his fiat ability, right? We start to lose sight of God the Mother in evolution. And we start to take on this delusional thing ourselves, and okay, I believe in evolution, but it's obviously in error here. The state that we're in, when we got through an evolutionary process, is an erroneous state, and I'm going to fix it. I'm going to build a better tomorrow, rather than I'm going to supply the favorable conditions so that a better tomorrow can be grown. Right? Saying unerringly is not unlike saying now is a divine dispensation, right? Like they do up, farther up in the book, right? It's the present moment, the present evolutionary state is a divine dispensation because that evolutionary process is unerring, right? There cannot be error because it's not the sum of a bunch of ignorant parts, the evolutionary process. It's the parts subject to the whole. In the finite, there's error. The whole is supreme. There is no error in the supreme. Okay? All finite error is non-existent in the context of this of supremacy. So that's another little element that kind of just slipped by that's very significant. Right? And it should, because you need to challenge yourself to not think so self-righteously about the state of the world around you. Fundamentally, there's no error. Even with rebellions and defaults, right, in the full bigness of the concept, right, in supremacy, there are no coincidences, all those sorts of things. Right? You can't lose sight of the big picture. Right? Take some little black spot that you find and blow it up right into the whole picture. It's a white background, an unerring background with a few black dots. But your initial spiritual consciousness doesn't have any natural tendency to think that way. Right? Because you can't think initially very holistically. You're started as a part-wise phenomenon. So, you know, your spiritual consciousness is an error and evil detector. Right? There's that black dot and that black dot and that black dot. Actually, that's all there is black dots. It's a black space. Right? Eventually, you lose yourself. And you lose all objectivity and start to do very unfortunate, radical, revolutionary things to try to stop the blackness from overcoming us all. Right? I got to start burning things and shooting. And this is where all those unfortunate, immature, spiritually conscious people go. Right? To revolution. So, Got to keep that in mind. Right? There's fundamentally no error in the whole. Right? So you can trust it. It will always serve you well. Take a deep breath and be patient. It's not all about you, and it's not all about this particular moment. Okay, so some lessons for the... You know, the planetary emergency there between the lines as well. All right, what else do we have here about the shamans and their shenanigans here?
Section 4, Medicine Under the Shamans. The entire life of ancient men was prophylactic. Their religion was in no small measure a technique for disease prevention. And regardless of the error in their theories, they were wholehearted in putting them into effect. They had unbounded faith in their methods of treatment, and that in itself is a powerful remedy.
Okay. So two things. The entire life of ancient man was prophylactic. Right? I mean, it's not just, relative to the immediate thing we're talking about here with disease and stuff. Okay. But just think about everything about their life. They have to be on guard, the literalness of the word. They have to be on guard about everything all the time, right? They have to be on guard with the hordes, next door that want to kill, everyone in the village. And just their entire life is about trying to be on guard with everything. So, it's all going to, religion is going to be all about disease prevention. Coming out of the shamans as medicine men and all this. Now we're getting to what I was hinting at early on. But regardless of the error of their theories, they were wholehearted, right, in putting them into effect. They had unbounded faith in their methods of treatment, and that in itself is a powerful remedy. Okay. So not only we're not just getting belief healing, but they're saying, okay, it isn't literally faith healing like you kind of think of it, which, you're just thinking belief healing, okay? But you can kind of add that in, okay? If someone brings in the upper domain, no matter how kind of unwitting it is, if they bring in the upper domain, that personalized self of spiritualized mind, like we were talking early on, of really spirit over mind, really taking that belief and giving it the realityization that only a personality can give to a personality wielding spirit on a mind can give to a mind, that solidity, that reality likeness to the mind. It can become a very focused, very consequential mind over matter phenomenon. Okay? It's like, yeah, but should they use wholehearted and faith? Well, again, remember, those words can always have a qualifier. It doesn't have to be true faith. It can be false faith. Right? Regardless of the error of their theories, right? The wholeheartedness doesn't have to be true. It could be false. Wholeheartedness. You know, love can be false love. Liberty can be false liberty. All those spirit words, right? You know, in your free will hands, you're sovereign up there. You can give it that mind and integrity as if it was in truth engaged to reality, reflecting reality, coordinated with reality. Or you can flip the sign and make it just as solid, but falsely, instead of truly. So that's what they're getting at. In a sense, even though the dictionary defines the word faith as merely a belief, a flavor of belief, you know, credulous belief, it humans still kind of have a feeling that when they use the word faith, it isn't, you know, literally merely just a synonym for belief. They have this sense that there's something a little bit greater about it. Even if they can't define it properly, they still end up defining it in terms of belief. You know, it's like between the lines, it's like, okay, yeah, I don't know what to call it except a belief, but I think it's really something more than that. They're pointing out it is, see, because there is this, if you literally bring in that kind of firmness, a wholeheartedness with a faith-like nucleus, see, you can bring that into play even though it's all erroneous. Okay. And as they're pointing out, initially, see, we progress in spite of ourselves. In spite of the fact that you're using your initial personal ability in a false mode instead of a true mode, the supreme mind, if you will, right, to take the biggest sense of it, can work with any set of facts and take them forward to goodness. Okay, so isn't it interesting that long before humans can possibly, especially if you have a default world where you don't have an Adam and Eve teaching them science, okay, long before they have any sort of genuine science to get at material things in some reasonable way, they can just bring in this false reification of their mind based upon whatever belief, whatever superstitious theory, and have their mind cure the disease. Yeah. And we can't forget that. I mean, science can teach you how to use matter to manipulate matter. You know, a certain drug to manipulate your molecules, you know, manipulating molecules with molecules. But no matter can ever manipulate matter as powerfully as mind, as effectively as mind can manipulate matter. Right? Your mind is not only dominant over the matter in your body, it's dominant over any other thing that you put in your body. The aspirin or whatever you stick in your body. Hey, your mind is dominant. So there, proper medicine always have to take into account that no matter how much pharmaceutical advancement we make, it's never going to be as powerful as mind. Right? The actual advancement in disease and stuff is not through pharmaceutical advancement, right? It's through genetic engineering. You'll just change the genetics until there is no disease, right? Like there's shouldn't have been if we'd gotten the full biologic uplift from Adam and Eve, right? Yeah, Adam and Eve aren't giving us fancy pharmaceuticals. They're just giving us genes that are above the vegetable level so that we don't get diseases. Okay.
And it's not our mind, it's the mind of the mother.
Yes, and of course, and just to remind it, fundamentally, the immediate mind that, you're utilizing is the size of Nebadon. That also will remind you of how powerful that mind can be, how much dominant over some little collection of molecules like my body that mind is. Who wins? A little pile of protoplasm or a mind, you can go beyond the local universe. In the higher sense, it's a mind of infinite size. Right? When all is said and done, is engaged to that little pile of protoplasm. Okay, it doesn't mean that you don't need science and stuff, but you know, in the case, like I was saying, of disease, you know, we don't ever lose sight of the natural way that disease is dealt with on a world is not through ever advancing pharmaceutical development. Right, it's just done genetically, and the problem is moot. Right, even on a world like ours, a decimal world, it has all kinds of curious malignant bacteria and viruses and stuff that a normal world doesn't have. Right? Again, it's all irrelevant. Doesn't matter how negative, quote unquote, the environment is, if you're just immune to it. Yeah, because it, you know, they loosened the restraints on the decimal world. It allowed a number of tangential, you know, phenomena to develop that normally aren't allowed because the constraints are tight and things can't squirt off like they did in various directions here. Yeah.
They weren't expecting the default to happen.
Yeah, right. See, and they knew that there would be stuff squirting off in all kinds of curious directions because how much they loosened the constraints, but they knew in the end it would, you know, wouldn't be an issue because the biologic uplift would make it all irrelevant, no matter, you know, how problematic technically, you know, the bacteria might be or something. Yeah.
Then again, how much is expected?
They did say though that all that stuff will be kind of like a super additive, great thing in the future, like the parasites. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, because no matter how negative, you know, how malignant, you know, quote unquote, it might appear, how bad it might appear to be, right, you know, in supremacy, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. So, progresses.
It's only when you focus on time that it appears to be bad. It isn't really bad. There, it really isn't any badness. Okay. Let's see. Where were we? I lost my. The page. Oh yeah, that's right. We just did the first paragraph. Yeah. Okay. We got everything there, didn't we? Yeah. Let's keep going.
The faith required to get well under the foolish ministrations of one of these ancient shamans was, after all, not materially different from that which is required to experience healing at the hands of some of his later day successors, who engage in the non-scientific treatment of disease.
All right, so they're pointing out, you know, we have all kinds, there's an endless proliferation of woo-woo medical schemes out there. And again, you know, molecularly, right, they're not valid. But again, it, you know, in many cases, it's irrelevant. Right? If a person predicated on whatever notion can get their mind so certain and consecrated that when whatever is done to them, it's effective, don't be surprised if it isn't effective. Right? As we've talked about before, okay, there's obviously going to be limits, but don't underestimate it, okay? There's a lot of potential there. If you can be ignorant enough and consecrated enough, you can do some amazing things to your body with your mind. But the moment you get any sort of scientific knowledge and that pollutes that ignorance, it's not going to work anymore. Okay, as they're going to point out here in a little bit. All right.
Instead of the good doctor, it's like, well, these are really good sales.
Yeah.
The more primitive tribes greatly feared the sick. For long ages, they were carefully avoided, shamefully neglected. It was a great advance in humanitarianism when the evolution of shamancraft produced priests and medicine men who consented to treat disease. Then it became customary for the entire clan to crowd into the sick room to assist the shaman in howling the disease ghosts away. It was not uncommon for a woman to be the diagnosing shaman, while a man would administer treatment. The usual method of diagnosing disease was to examine the entrails of an animal.
Okay, so in usual human fashion, right, the pendulum swings all the way completely to the other side. Absolutely no one would get within a mile of them. Then everyone is all right on top of them, hands on, and smearing bodily juices all over themselves. And so it's just a hilarious little story there. But obviously at some point, it's going to start really hopelessly like this, but you've got to swing it around so that there can actually be doctors that will engage a sick person. Right? So it starts out with full zeal. I see full sixth adjutant religious zeal about it. You can just, then it became customary for the entire clan. So the religious impulse is fully in play here, and you're going to have to temper the sixth adjutant a bit with the fourth adjutant over time. And hope that that despite the default, the life carriers designed us with enough disease resistance that all mankind is not going to die out during this stage of contagious diseases. You probably are going to cull the herd pretty significantly during this stage, but it's going to be kind of like the Permian extinction, right? When all is said and done, all the lesser genetics is going to die out here. We saw it again once you develop cities and put everyone all together in cities, right? It's going to be a little bit separating the genetic wheat from the chaff there. As all the lesser genetics is going to die out in the swamp of the city. But you're going to have a more resilient core coming out the other side. And of course, now we're kind of working in reverse. We have just enough scientific knowledge to keep people from dying, but not enough to, literally eliminate the genetic issue. So now we have more and more weak genetics being proliferated and procreating, and the problem is getting genetically worse and worse and worse, with each generation now. If you look at charts of the extent of genetic-related disorders, it's an alarming exponential curve here. I mean, it's going up just very rapidly because of just what I'm saying. Those people that are not dying now. Like I always point out myself, I mean, I shouldn't, be here. My dad was a diabetic. He would have died. Right? But instead, that weak genetics gets passed on through me. Right, and my brothers, and we pass it on to our kids, and all of those things are getting fed forward. We might cure cancer in an individual, but the genetic weakness that led to that person getting cancer is passed on, through procreation. Right, and so, we've got this difficult period until we can get sophisticated enough to actually stop just treating diseases like this and eliminating our susceptibility to diseases by changing our genetics, effectively doing what Adam and Eve would have done to our DNA. Genetic engineering is going to play a huge role on this planet, more than on the normal world. It plays a very, very big role on a normal world, but it's going to play a massive role on this world. Okay. All right, keep going.
Disease was treated by chanting, howling, laying on of hands, breathing on the patient, and many other techniques. In later times, the resort to temple sleep, during which healing supposedly took place, became widespread. The medicine men eventually essayed actual surgery in connection with temple slumber. Among the first operations was that of trephining the skull to allow a headache spirit to escape. The shamans learned to treat fractures and dislocations, to open boils and abscesses. the shamanesses became adept at midwifery.
Okay, so here we are getting this surgery going, but you know, before that, like I said, you know, they're laying on of hands, you know, just, it's not, they're not just standing there, but you know, they're touching it, smearing it all over themselves. It's like, oh boy.
That's okay, my headache went away. I don't think I need my
headphones. You know, and as we'll see in a little bit, you know, water was thought to be really important, you know, so sweating, so you make sure you're sweating and you're smearing their sweat all over you, and you know, it's just, it's like, oh my gosh. A giant petri dish.
Now.
What was that?
They have exorcisms over because of the, you know, people are taking some sort of drug and they get sort of weird and they say, oh, he's being obsessed by the devil.
Yeah, so we've launched into this wonderful new experiment here in doctoring, but you know they essayed, you know, they tried out, you know, the literalness of the word, going to, you know, try their hand at actual surgery, and it's you know it's trephination, but it's tree fining. All right, making a circular hole in the skull. You know, remember, you know, it's not that long ago we started finding some of these skulls, you know, where they'd obviously had that operation many, many, many times. You know, because, you know, there's several holes in their head, you know, some of which that, you know, had grown, the bone had grown, you know, almost all the way back together or totally together. And, you know, and you can see, you know, what's the oldest hole and what's the youngest hole by just how much it's grown, you know, before they died. They probably died of the last hole that was drilled in their head, right? You know?
Yeah. How do you even have one
repeat? You know, the 15th hole in their head. And coincidentally, they died at that point.
And they started eating meadowsweet, which has psilocybin acid in it, and their headaches.
But you can see, you know, not only that, but, you know, Lansing boils and, you know, saying, you know, I mean, you know, they are starting to get the concept of you've got some stuff inside that's not helping. If I can get it out, and of course, there's some validity to that, but we all know, you know, you go forward almost to modern times of, you know, trying to get the bad humors out of someone in various ways, you know, put leeches on them or whatever. So, you know, that basic concept of there's badness inside of them and I need to, you know, get that badness out. That was very, very dominant thought, you know, until extremely recent times. And, you know, and again, there's, you know, there's some validity there, but you make it an ism, you know, you make it a complete lifestyle solution and you rationalize everything. You know, instead of having a ghost inside of him or a spirit inside of him that he's trying to get out, you know, and then it's magics inside of him, you're trying to get the magic out, you know, then you're eventually thinking that there's literal material stuff inside them that you have to get out. It's just see the evolution of that same concept. all right.
It was a common method of treatment to rub something magical on an infected or blemished spot on the body, throw the charm away, and supposedly experience a cure. If anyone should chance to pick up the discarded charm, it was believed he would immediately acquire the infection or blemish. It was a long time before herbs and other real medicines were introduced. Massage was developed in connection with incantation, rubbing the spirit out of the body, and was preceded by efforts to rub medicine in, even as moderns attempt to rub liniments in. Cupping and sucking the affected parts, together with bloodletting, were thought to be of value in getting rid of a disease-producing spirit.
Okay, so we already kind of talked about all the different ways that you're playing on that basic assumption, like I said, that even if it goes to a basically a totally physical concept, it's just the evolution of get the spirit out, right? You know, now you're trying to get the you know, the matter out that shouldn't be in there. And you know, occasionally, despite all of the foolishness of the theory behind this, you know, this method, right, there is some validity to the method in certain areas. And, you know, we can, you know, there's an initial tendency to just throw out all those superstitious techniques. We know we've kind of, we're getting going where some of the modern, medical people are going back and thinking again about some of those things. Like, well, actually, now that I think about it, there was some validity to that, even though he had no clue of why there was some validity. So we're going back and rediscovering some of the accidental discoveries that people made through all these superstitious approaches to disease. Not only techniques, but various herbal, remedies and stuff, actually thinking about them chemically, it's not just woo-woo, there's actually a chemical in that stuff that, does have an effect.
Quackery in the 1800s, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Herbs were.
Yeah, right.
I like seeing that they consider them to be real.
Right, yeah, because they're coming back around. But again, remember that, it's actually a little bit of a fool's errand to go back and try to discover the validity of those old medicines, because, like they pointed out, more consequential than the molecules of old medicines is the belief in the effectiveness of those and the utter ignorance of any physics to it, right? If you bring in any sort of physics thinking about it, it destroys the effect of the mind engaging this. That's the irony. The more magical the thought is, the more effective this mind over body thing is in terms of disease. It's a very tricky thing, as they're about to explain, like I said. Yeah, it's a kind of a, right.
Now that you've brought that back,
mm-hmm.
In the past I wanted to add this, besides mind over matter,
mm-hmm.
making things better, you could make yourself sick.
Yes, right. And obviously the opposite is the case. I mean, and we kind of understand that various mental states have a physiological consequence. If you very, very aggressively have a certain state of mind, it leads to problems in your intestine or something, right? And again, it can work in the opposite direction. And a lot of times when there was belief healing with Jesus, the person maybe was, it was fundamentally, Jesus was stimulating them to take their mind out of this unfortunate state it was in, put it back in a more right form. And remember, sometimes it wasn't just a mental abnormality that they were suffering from. It was severe enough, a mental distortion, that it was leading to physical manifestation, has physiological consequences. And so when he got them kind of back in a right mind, even though he didn't do anything directly with them at all, he just got them to think differently, the body consequences cleared up subsequently too.
They picked up their bad
walk. Yeah, right. an awful lot of the stuff that happened in the, with the sort of mobile hospital thing of Jesus's public ministry, there was no direct action, on his part at all. It was just in this mode. You have ignorant enough people, they can just straighten themselves out in a lot of ways. All right. Let's see here. What else did we have there? Anything else? I think we got everything. Oh, that's right. There was one other thing that's really funny. That whole bit with the charm. Yeah, so you can just imagine you rub this contagious stuff all over this charm, throw it out, and sort of immediately some little kid finds it and picks it up and gets the contagious disease, if it hasn't been sitting out long enough for the ultraviolet to kill it or whatever, So, not to mention you probably threw it in a hidden place, so that there wasn't any sunlight on it. And obviously that could, and as soon as someone had that happen, as soon as that someone picked, you know, got that contagious disease. Well, then you've proved the theory. See, you have a confirmation of the theory, so now the theory is valid. And see, again, remember, confirmations don't prove anything. You know, I can't say that enough, right? Our political discourse is hopeless, right? Because people think that confirmations prove something. I mean, our scientific discourse is becoming hopeless because scientists think that confirmations prove something. So important to think about these simple examples from the past. Oh yeah, that would have seemed to validate that theory, wouldn't it? So you gotta don't let your natural mind slip into that mode of thinking that confirmations are significant. And the more you want it to be significant, the more difficult it is for you to remind yourself that it's not significant. Right? You like the conclusion that it implies, so you'll go with it.
Since water was a potent fetish, it was utilized in the treatment of many ailments. For long, it was believed that the spirit causing the sickness could be eliminated by sweating. Vapor baths were highly regarded. Natural hot springs soon blossomed as primitive health resorts. Early man discovered that heat would relieve pain. He used sunlight, fresh animal organs, hot clay, and hot stones, and many of these methods are still employed. Rhythm was practiced in an effort to influence the spirits. The tom-toms were universal.
Yeah, I mean, at least when you go to the health resort, they just put the hot stones on you and not the fresh animal organs.
Yeah. More expensive than the
end. Right. Cucumbers and hot stones, and yeah. And you're cured.
Look at that menu.
We all know that these things are happening right around us today, the latest incarnations of these ideas. And again, you just see every way that they could rationalize something going out, like sweat going out. You know, that's going to be the key. You'll sweat out the disease, or you know, all these various notions of that are all just variations of there's a spirit inside. We need to get the spirit out. We all know the whole tom-tom thing is, a little aside there, apart from disease curing, you know, don't forget how the general religious ritual, plays off of the music and the tom-tom thing and whatnot, too. I mean, it's, you know, the two are feeding each other back and forth, kind of the medicine man side of the shaman, you know, impacts the priest side of the shaman and vice versa. And so the degree to which you seem to have success with the tom-tom method in curing a disease, you're going to be certain that that's going to make your religious ritual more effective and God is going to, you know, pay more attention to you and give you what you want. You know, if the organ music is fancy enough, God can't resist answering your prayers or whatever your thought is.
Among some people, disease was thought to be caused by a wicked conspiracy between spirits and animals. This gave rise to the belief that there existed a beneficent plant remedy for every animal-caused disease. The Red Men were especially devoted to the plant theory of universal remedies. They always put a drop of blood in the root hole left when the plant was pulled up.
Okay, that little aside, you know, we were just talking about herbal remedies and stuff. See, they're giving you the little behind the scenes. How did that actually get started? It didn't get started in some molecular, you know, organic chemistry sort of mode, right? It was literally this notion that, well, humans and animals are, you know, I mean, humans, you know, they still believed in evolution, basically. Right? I mean, they thought of a very tight connection between humans and animals. And so if there's a certain notion with them, if you're going to contend against that, you're going to address that, you need to go to other, right? And the other is plants, right? I mean, we have, the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, right? I mean, that's our basic, pair, and so that was how they thought about it. Well, if animal's the problem, the other's the solution. Now, kind of the interesting thing that they give you, and they talk about, the life carriers and stuff in our actual design, between the lines there, remember that there's that very harsh little reminder about the fact that we are so susceptible to bacteria and viruses is because our lack of biologic uplift leaves us basically biologically at the plant level, so that we're subject to a plant assault. Right? Now, that's remember how when we talked about that, it's like, oh, that's kind of harsh. They're telling me I'm basically a potted plant and that's why I get sick. If only I was a fancy animal instead of a potted plant, I wouldn't get so sick. Yeah, see, that's kind of what's between the lines there. I mean, it's literally, that's how much biologic uplift we need. We're still, remember, you start with nothing but plants, and then it evolves into animals with a suddenly. I mean, we're still so close to, the bottom of that suddenly, up from plants to animals, that's why we're so susceptible. So, boy, just a little biologic uplift, see? It just reminds you that, like we were talking earlier, on a normal world, you get the full biologic uplift. In many ways, it's not getting, it's sort of just getting you initially bounded up away from the vegetable level with that biologic uplift. The whole process of going up to the fullness of an animal origin human. So, you have to really kind of get bounded away from the plant and really be kind of more definitively animal origin human. That whole process of going the rest of the way up in that animal nature is done with genetic engineering on every world. All right? It's just kind of reminding you of, Adam and Eve just sort of really definitively get you bounded away from the plant. Right? And the rest of the process of going up through the animal spectrum of mind is done by genetic engineering. So again, that's that, our initial efforts are going to get us above the plant level definitively, but then we're going to have that whole process of refining genetics beyond what Adam and Eve can do with their children and mating.
But unfortunately, there's a lot of, how should we say, fear and misunderstanding that we're playing with God.
Yeah, afterwards.
So I think until that threshold is circumvented or, gotten around, it's probably going to start out with curing diseases.
Yes, it is. Yeah, of course. Right.
We
have a lot of fear right now, and I mean ever-growing fear about genetic engineering, right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a difficult process.
But it's a given that there will be mistakes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there will be errors. All that is valid. Think about some of the things that in the Revelation that you might not have initially thought about in this way. The very fact that they tell you there's life carriers, that God didn't literally manipulate matter into a single-celled plant and put it into it. Not even a creator being. It's just a creature. A life carrier is the one that actually designed the life and put it in the shallow seas. Oh, well, I guess they weren't playing God, so I'm probably not playing God either. If you can recognize that it was creatures, not God, that actually arranged the molecules into the DNA.
Refresh my memory, who creates life carriers?
Well, life carriers have a threefold parentage. The Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit, you know, like a lot of local universe sons, but a third element, an Ancient of Days, feeds in because they need that direct contact with the Trinity, so that the Paradise Trinity, so that there's a direct conduit of Mother Deity in their heritage, apart from, you know, the Mother Deity and the Creative Mother Spirit is glued to Spirit Deity. They need a pure Mother Deity conduit because by nature they have to be able to give the first phase of life animation just the way they are. That they do that because of their Ancient of Days heritage. They do the second phase of life animation, the reproductive spark, because of their tie to Mother Deity connected to Spirit with the Creative Mother Spirit. And those are two different conduits for life animation.
Which is interesting, because they even admit in the book that, you know, they say, well, we didn't foresee this problem happening, you know, which was the one
right.
that we were talking about.
You yeah. know, and like Gene was just saying, we're going to do some things. Oh, we didn't foresee that problem happening. But see, that's not playing God. That's not some evil thing. That's just the way it works in an evolutionary universe.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other thing, just more even more general than the fact of life carriers and stuff, we live on an experimental world, right? So, playing God, no, it's a totally inappropriate thought.
But it's there.
But it's there nonetheless. See, yeah, it's a superstition that will have to be overcome through a lot of difficult process.
Is it all on our shoulders, or will it be overseen?
No, eventually, yeah. I mean, that's why, you know, a lot of the revelators think that when Machiaventi Melchizedek assumes full planetary prince overtly, that he's also going to assume the role of material son, i.e., genetic modification mentor, right? That he'll take up that role of helping us with the scientific understanding to begin to do genetic engineering. That's what that whole material son role of him is about. He's not going to serve as a biologic uplifter like with Midzanites, right? I mean, he's just going to do that scientific education role that Adam and Eve normally do, right? As the material son. You know, and if, you know, they're going, well, if it's not him, you know, someone's going to have to step in and do this, right? You know, he's just very, you know, it's the simplest assumption that he would do it, because he could do it. But who knows? It's a, you know, it's a wild card world, you know. they could bring in some being that is not even revealed in the Urantia book, for all we know. Right? Who knows what might happen? For all they know, right? Yeah.
Could some of it be being done right now?
I mean, in minor ways, right, you've got that whole bit about conserving, you know, the higher spiritual types. In other words, the better genetic individuals that you can seat more spiritualized mind on. Right, I mean, there are some kind of ad hoc things that are going on, but right, I mean, they're hoping that at some point it's more systematic, right? And it's not just kind of the subtle things that the Master Seraphim might be doing, you know, and whatnot, but a more direct engagement of it, like Adam and Eve are supposed to do, right? Take it on overtly, not behind the scenes and subtly and stuff, but, you know, take it head on, you know. You know, everyone who's interested, sign up for this genetic engineering class, right? That's being held at the planetary headquarters.
And Adolf.
Like that.
Back a while.
Right. Okay. So. All right.
Fasting, dieting, and counter irritants were often used as remedial measures. Human secretions, being definitely magical, were highly regarded. Blood and urine were thus among the earliest medicines and were soon augmented by roots and various salts. The shamans believed that diseased spirits could be driven out of the body by foul-smelling and bad-tasting medicines. Purging very early became a routine treatment, and the values of raw cocoa and quinine were among the earliest pharmaceutical discoveries.
Ah, there's some pharmaceutical finally coming in. And of course, Doc Kellogg, had a lot to do with revivifying the whole purging concept, there's every, enema magic thing you can think of out there now. But see, again, it's all just this idea of there's an ill spirit inside and you got to get it out, whether you think of it literally as a spirit being possessing someone, just metaphorically, it's an ill spirit. They're just pointing out you get to this, you've got this really foul-smelling stuff in your intestines. I bet if we get that out, that'll fix you. This power is foul-smelling and bad-tasting. And, why did you have to take those bad-tasting medicines when you were a kid? This is why, right? It's just this shamanistic theory, right? That's going to cure you if the medicine tastes bad. We're just barely, liberated from some of this stuff. Bringing in not only blood, but urine. All these, it doesn't matter how silly the notion is, the power of your internal organs to purify urine, right, is in play here. The humans don't know that, but it's a purer thing than some of the drinking water that they were thinking was magical and pouring on someone, right? Like if they were living in Paris and the rainwater soaked down through all the levels of the catacombs and then down through the sewers and then down into the drinking supply, and then they took that drinking water and poured it on a wound, open wound. Oh boy, that's really going to fix that wound, isn't it? Right? It'd be better to bring some urine into play, right? And then that wonderful drinking water.
Perrier.
yes. And hence we invent Perrier. Yes.
Chris's
how to lose weight
diet plan. Get
a
recording of it
whenever
you
want. No appetite can survive. But it's just, they're reminding you of how accidental, all this stuff was. And fundamentally, it's just we progress in spite of ourselves. See, no matter how clueless we are, no matter how foolish our notions are, coincidentally, we'll stumble on things because the conspiracy is afoot. The parts are subject to the whole. You can't do anything else but back into truth. Right? There's no escaping. Right?
It's all worth it if we got chocolate.
Yeah, if we got chocolate out of it. It makes the whole shamanism thing worth it in the end if we get chocolate out of it. Yes. Okay. Final paragraph here.
The Greeks were the first to evolve truly rational methods of treating the sick. Both the Greeks and the Egyptians received their medical knowledge from the Euphrates Valley. Oil and wine was a very early medicine for treating wounds. Castor oil and opium were used by the Sumerians. Many of these ancient and effective secret remedies lost their power when they became known. Secrecy has always been essential to the successful practices of fraud and superstition. Only facts and truth court the full light of comprehension and rejoice in the illumination and enlightenment of scientific research.
Okay, see, so there it is. The place where they directly speak to what I've been saying to, right, in the book. So you finally get some science going with the Greeks, but once it goes beyond, kind of the wizard, that is mysteriously practicing this science, once people have a more general sense of the physics of it, the science of it, to a large degree, it loses effect,
yeah.
Right? I mean, some of these things you can say, well, okay, just, literally molecularly, there's you're not going to lose everything, okay, but it's going to be very limited. It's not going to be the panacea that it once was, where it could cure all kinds of things, right? Even though molecularly it has no right to do that, if you will. Right? That whole bit of the ignorance involved, you know, and the profound belief in the effectiveness of the woo-woo.
That's the mind over matter.
Yeah. So think about what this implies about, okay, so now we've lost that woo-woo effect, you know, if you will, and we have just the science. But eventually, doctors in the distant future, they're gonna somehow bring this back in. How are we gonna bring back in the power of the mind relative, you know, and yet not be, you know, ignorant, superstitious, you know, people, or, you know, or totally turning ourselves over to fraudulent, like they're saying there, you know, fraud and superstition, these totally fraudulent, deceitful shamans, you know, who know full well that nothing they're doing has any effectiveness, you know, it's all just a scheme to enrich themselves, and yet, you know, they aren't immediately executed because their fraud works. Because of the ignorant people they're engaging.
So I can answer that one way.
Yeah.
My mother was sponsored to study at Harvard University about 20 years ago, and they had 600 patients in each study, total of 1,800, and they all had a similar heart disease. And so some were not prayed for, mm-hmm. some were prayed for and not told, uh-huh. and some were prayed for and told.
Mm-hmm.
And the results were absolutely phenomenal. The people that were prayed for and told were about 85% better than the people that were prayed for and not told.
Mm-hmm.
And they were another 50% better than the people that weren't prayed for.
Yeah.
So this the way to bring the mind back in the way without, you know, the scientific thing is being able, maybe, you know, with prayer or through the spiritual or through the religious side of things that make people help them believe.
But see, again, you know, if
I understand what you're going to
say. Yeah, see, you know, if the Arantia book is effective, you know, as we go through the next paper and kind of getting us out of the old mode of prayer is going to, you know, be altered here too. So see, this is a problem where there might be a next evolutionary solution, but then that's going to, you know, so it's just really interesting to think about how does this work in the fifth stage of light and life on a world, right, or something, right? I mean, how is mind, you know, brought more effectively into play? Now, you know, remember, of course, we've completely reworked the body, and, you know, and eugenics has eliminated all of the, you know, defectives and, you know, whatnot. Yeah, but still, you know, this is interesting stuff about the physics of the mind of the body. You know, and it's like, well, why does it need such kind of lack of scientific precision for it to work better? The reason is because mind isn't just above the matter. Mind is transcendently above matter. For mind to affect matter the most, the wholeness of mind has to be focused on one and one and every point of matter. It has to be that transcendent engagement. The more you kind of bring in consciously the minutiae of your matter, like I have this particular cancerous, you know, tumor that I wanted to focus on, the more you're going to drag down to and kind of distort your mind so that it's you're thinking of it more like two sheets of paper laying on top of each other, and, you know, one point on the top sheet of paper touches one point on the bottom sheet of paper, etc., over the whole thing. But see, mind does, you know, especially effective mind, doesn't engage matter in that point-to-point-like way. The fullness of mind is all of the mind engages each point, not point-to-point, but whole-to-point. Mm-hmm. And that's why, see, that's when the full domination of, see, the more it's point to point, the more it's like molecule to molecule, the more it's like matter to matter. It's in that transcendent engagement. See, and that's why this is effective, right? When you totally let go of it, the full wholeness to point of the mind's effect is in play. But if you get a hold of it and kind of partize your mind and think of it in kind of a point-to-point thing, it loses a lot of its effectiveness. The higher the mind, the more holistic there is this. See? And so that's the that's what's between the lines, the physics of why this works, why this ignorance, why this secrecy and stuff that works. And as soon as you lose the secrecy, it doesn't, because people start thinking materially about their mind instead of mindily about their mind. That's something to consider. I mean, see, so that going forward into the future, that you'll have people that'll have much more of a direct physics of mind. See, and they won't be thinking materially about their mind; they'll be thinking mindily about their mind, and that will bring the mind over matter into full effect. In the absence of ignorance, right? Not more knowledge of matter, see, which makes it worse. The new knowledge about mind will get you to the other side and get it better again. We're in the adolescent stage of our knowledge of matter is matterizing our mind. We need to transcend that and get to the physics of mind, and then you'll bring the effect back in.
If I had my way, I wouldn't have anything linear in my mind at all. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I do strive to pay attention to linear is because of you and your point by point, word by word. Also, like total deity, I do like having some of that linear, but it's very difficult for me to go that way.
Right. Again, it's not, you know, it's not a dichotomy.
It's not like I could just skip it like I've always wanted.
See,
to.
See, part of it. The thing that's, you, even though eventually you want that philosophic wholeness instead of the scientific pointleness, you can't get to that philosophic wholeness without that point precision. You know, it's the individuality and the unity that come together super additively to give you that wholeness. I see. So, you know, the important thing is just to not get stuck on the individuality, the matter, the point, the fact, right? Think of it as a means to a higher end, right? When the scientists don't think of it as a means to a higher end, you end up with philosophic materialism. Okay, so
that's probably not related to your circles.
Your circle development, remember, those are cosmic levels, right? They're levels of wholeness that you're ascending, right?
And you know a lot of people have that kind of mind ability today?
No.
No, okay.
No. I mean...
But if we were to be transported to a planet like life, we'd probably see that.
Yeah. Well, even remember, if you were transported to a normal world in the post-Pistole Sun Age, it would completely boggle your mind. Pardon the pun. The way mind, was being utilized there. Yeah, so holistic you can't even imagine it.
Chris, they'd have you in a bottle.
Yeah, you'd have to observe it from your hermetically sealed, bottle, so that you didn't genetically contaminate the place. But right, but nonetheless, they can give you a porthole to look through. All right. So next time, this final section is the preface to the following paper on prayer. We're gonna transition, into considering prayer next time, and continue on into the paper on prayer. So finally, after teasing it and frustrating ourselves with that for a long time, we're going to get to that subject. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.